about this congregation, about God, about the Bible, about your life and how we might be able to help you in whatever situation that you're in. But we are glad that you are here this morning. Daniel chapter 1. Well, this week starts our VBS, which is just a fancy way of saying we're going to be having classes, Bible classes for kids all throughout the week here at the building from 9:30 to 11:30, and certainly are looking forward to that. The teachers have been working hard to get ready, and the young people I know are excited, and it's always one of my favorite weeks of the year. It's so enjoyable to watch young people get together and sing and learn more about God. This year, of course, we're doing Days of Daniel, and so we're going to be talking this week about stories from the book of Daniel that are familiar, I think, to many of us, but so important for our children. And I want to start the week off by talking with you a little bit this morning from Daniel chapter 1, kind of the prologue to the book, the introduction to the book, Daniel chapter 1. Because I do think that these stories as a whole are so very relevant, not just to kids because of their memorability and the magnificent nature of what goes on and the miracles that occur. But I think it's a book that's still very relevant, and the stories are very relevant to adults especially as well today. Even though many of us have known these stories since we have been children. During the week, we'll be talking about the stories in Daniel 2, Daniel 3, Daniel 5, and Daniel 6. But Daniel chapter 1 kind of serves as a prologue to the book. It's the beginning of the book where we first meet Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, who we better know as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their given Babylonian names. We first meet them in this chapter, and the decisions that they make in this chapter really form the basis for all that goes on with them in chapters 2, chapter 3, chapter 5, and chapter 6. Chapter 4, of course, being about the humbling of King Nebuchadnezzar himself by God. The good decisions that they make, the stands that they take, the dangers that they face in chapters 3, 2, 3, 5, and 6, all that goes on there ultimately begins from the basis of the decisions that they make about who they are, what they're going to be, and what their lives are going to stand for in Daniel chapter 1. And so as a prologue to the book, as a prologue to the week, I want to spend some time this morning talking with you about this book from Daniel chapter 1. And again, I think it's especially important because these stories are not just for children. It's never been an easy thing to live a godly life in the midst of a godless society. And sometimes as we read the newspaper and struggle in our own personal situations in life with unbelieving family, godless workplace, godless school systems, whatever our personal situation, whatever we're dealing with, we often think that it's the worst it's ever been, or that nobody understands what it's like, or that nobody has faced what we face. And the Bible, especially in the stories, wants us to understand that's simply not true. In fact, in many of the Bible stories, some of the people that are most familiar to us from its pages have actually faced situations or had to live in cultures that are even worse than what we deal with, as depraved as our own time is. And Daniel chapter 1, the prologue of the book, shows us that, as well as it shows us the decisions that Daniel and his colleagues make, because it's never been easy to be godly in a godless age, but it can be done. But especially in Daniel chapter 1, Daniel shows us how. He shows us not so much through particular circumstances he faced, though there is a circumstance that drives chapter 1, but there will be others that come. This chapter especially shows us the mind and the heart of Daniel and the difference that makes when the situations in our lives come that tempt us to compromise with the world. And of course, the particular power and memorability of Daniel's story is not only does he survive his own situation, but he thrives and he changes the empire, in a sense, with him. Where even in Daniel chapter 4, King Nebuchadnezzar himself, the greatest ruler the world has yet seen at that point in human history, the most powerful ruler over the largest mass of land, he himself is forced to confess that the God of Daniel, the God of heaven, the Most High God, is Lord of all the earth. Well, Daniel chapter 1, hopefully you found it. Now let's start reading chapter 1. In verse 1, and get the story before us. It was in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God. And he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. And then the king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his officials, to bring in some of the sons of Israel, including some of the royal family of the nobles, youths in whom was no defect, who were good-looking, who showed intelligence in every branch of wisdom, endowed with understanding and discerning knowledge, and who had ability for serving in the king's court. And he ordered him to teach them the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed for them a daily ration from the king's choice food and from the wine which he drank. And he appointed that they should be educated for 3 years, at the end of which they were to enter the king's personal service. Now among them from the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Then the commander of the officials assigned new names to them. To Daniel he assigned the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel made up his mind, literally in Hebrew, he set his heart, that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, "I'm afraid of my lord, the king, who has appointed your food and your drink. For why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king." But Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. And let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be observed in your presence and the appearance of the youths who are eating the king's choice food. And deal with your servants according to what you see." So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their appearance seemed better. And they were fatter than all the youths who had been eating the king's choice food. So the overseer continued to withhold their choice food and the wine they were to drink and kept giving them vegetables. As for these 4 youths, God gave them knowledge and intelligence in every branch of literature and wisdom. Daniel even understood all kinds of visions and dreams. Then at the end of the days, which the king had specified for presenting them, the commander of the officials presented them before Nebuchadnezzar. And the king talked with them, and out of them all, not one was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so they entered the king's personal service. As for every manner of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. All right, so this story really serves as again, prologue to the whole book of all that's going to come in chapters 2 through 6, the stories that we are going to read. And it even hints at that with verses 21's note that it goes up until the first year of Cyrus. That's when chapter 6 happens, when Daniel has to, in the days of the early days of the Persian Empire, be thrown to the lions. This story revolves around the fact that Daniel and his friends set their heart, they made their mind, they made a determination that they would not defile themselves, that they would not be acculturated, that they would not compromise, that they would not change who they were and what they were about, that they would not worship other gods, that they would not acknowledge the ultimate power of Babylon and Nebuchadnezzar as its king. And they knew that there was one true God in heaven, that he had said what is right and what is wrong, that he demands absolute loyalty and allegiance, and nothing about their circumstances would cause them to waver in those convictions. And so this story basically sets out what's going on here. The story begins by acknowledging, we don't always catch it culturally, but it's an insult to Israel's God. The story begins in chapter 1 with the fact that Nebuchadnezzar takes not just the youths back to Babylon, but he takes some of the vessels of the temple. He takes some of the vessels of the house of God, verse 2 says. He brings them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. That is his way of worshiping his God, and basically saying, in a way that all ancient peoples would have understood, that my God is more powerful than Israel's God. My God is stronger than Israel's God. That's why I have Israel's God's stuff. And so I'll take it back and I'll put it in my God's temple and worship him with it by giving it to him and putting it in his treasury, because my God is stronger than Israel's God and my God has given me Israel's God's stuff. You see what's going on there? It is actually an insult to Israel's gods. It's a way of saying that Israel's God is nothing. My God is more powerful. And then he goes on And he brings the cream of the crop to his court. This is the 605 deportation. Those of you who think a little bit more in terms of explicit historical framework, this is the deportation that happens in 605. Jerusalem is not destroyed yet, but what basically Nebuchadnezzar does in his first visit to Jerusalem is he takes tribute from Israel's temple. That's a way of saying to them and to his own people that the gods of Babylon are stronger than the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But then the second thing he does is he takes the cream of the crop. He takes young people from the royal family, the smart people, the good-looking people, the beautiful people, the A-list people in life, and he takes them with him back to Babylon. They do a couple of things. Number one, to basically take away the next generation of leadership from Israel, or from Judah rather, to take away the next generation of leadership. Number two, to create a hostage situation as well. If you think about rebelling, stopping to pay tribute, or not serving me any longer, I have now what are not just servants, I have hostages. I can send your children's heads back to you in a basket if you think about trying anything. Don't do it. And number three, then what he wants to do, number three, is he wants to turn Jews into Babylonians. And that's the emphasis upon the education that these people are to receive. They're smart, they're brilliant, yes, so I will educate them, but I will not educate them in their own ways. I will not teach them the laws of their God. I will not teach them about their culture. I will make them into Babylonians. I will teach them. I will teach them. Look in verse 4. They will be taught the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. I'm going to turn these Jews into Babylonians. Now, what will that do? That will accomplish several things. That will, number one, give him a propaganda point. He will now have young Jewish people who can write home to mom and dad and the people back in Jerusalem and say, you know, Babylon's a wonderful place. They know so much more than we do. They're smarter than we are. Listen, Jerusalem's backwater. We need to be more like the Babylonians because they know great things and they can do great things. And so it's a propaganda point. The other thing that it also accomplishes is that, again, it allows him to basically gather the best minds from all the peoples that he conquers, gather the best of the best minds, no matter what ethnicity they come from, gather them and put them in his own personal service. Now, think about it. That's a good way to run a business or an empire, isn't it? To gather the smartest people you can find, no matter where you find them, give them the education you need them to have to serve you well. And that's what Nebuchadnezzar does. And so he's attempting to make Jews and the Babylonians. But here's what you've got to understand when they learn about the literature and the language of the Chaldeans. What's going on here is not just reading, writing, and arithmetic as we think about school today. You know, we talk about separation of church and state in this country and how the government's not supposed to proselytize for any particular religious view or standpoint. That was not how it works in the ancient world. Education always had a religious and a moral dimension as well. To learn about the literature of the Chaldeans means that Daniel and his friends would have been taught about Babylonian values. They would have been taught about Babylonian religion. They would have been taught about Babylonian beliefs, about astrology and beliefs and omens and signs and all sorts of pagan, dark, occultic type practices, because that's what the Babylonians, the Chaldeans, practiced. That's what they did. Daniel would have been taught how to do astrology. He would have been taught how to tear animals apart and discern from the condition of the liver what the future will be. All sorts of weird practices the Chaldeans engaged upon. That's what Daniel would have been taught, because Nebuchadnezzar was not just trying to make them technically proficient. He was trying to make them culturally, religiously, and spiritually like him. And so he tries to make Jews into Babylonians. And then he assumes that everybody has a price. He assumes that everybody has a price. Along with their education, it's not a tough situation to be in, because they get basically a share of the king's own rations. They get to eat like the king eats. They get to drink what the king drinks. What's that about? Well, ultimately what that's really about is not just trying to force good Jewish boys to eat unclean food. What that's really about is patronage. What that's really about is patronage. Everybody has a price. Listen, you do things my way and life can be really good. You can eat what I eat. You can drink what I drink. You can live like I live. You can be one of my servants. You can be one of my good guys. You can be on my team. You can be on the team. Everybody has a price. And so I'll share the good things of what it means to be one of the king's guys with you. It's about patronage. from Nebuchadnezzar's point of view. And again, that's part of why the servants who are mentoring Daniel's friends through these things are so concerned. It's not just a matter of you guys won't fatten up like everybody else as such. It's also a matter of to reject the king's food is like turning down the generous gift from a rich patron. Especially, and it's dangerous to do when that patron is not just rich, but that patron is also powerful. It's basically saying, no thanks, I don't want to be on your team. I don't have a price. You're not paying me enough. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to have what you have. I don't want to be what you are. It's a dangerous thing to do. The challenge Nebuchadnezzar's assumption that everybody has a price. If I offer you enough of this world's goods, you will be willing to become part of the world. And Daniel and his friends determined that they would not defile themselves, that they would not endorse the Babylonian regime by sharing in the Babylonian values, that they would not eat what they ate. They would not become like them. They didn't have a price. Well, what is that all about then? It's about young men who fear God. It's about young men who fear God. The commander of the officials in verse 10 is afraid of the king. I am afraid of my lord, the king, who's appointed your food and your drink. You don't tell this guy, no, Daniel, you don't understand. I'm afraid of him. Daniel's and his friends, they fear a different ruler, a higher ruler. One who, before this book is over, this book will make very clear, a higher ruler who determines who rules in the affairs of men in the first place. What we meet in this book is young men who fear God. And we also meet in this book a God who provides what is needed. Listen, from the world's perspective, when Nebuchadnezzar takes God's stuff and puts it in the temple of his God, it looks like God is powerless and out of control in this situation. God has finally met his match. But the fact of the matter is this book, through the stories it tells us, reminds us that even when it looks like God is vulnerable or beaten or out of control or vanquished, he's still there, subtly, providentially, in the scenes and behind the scenes to make sure that his purposes are accomplished. And so in chapter 1 and verse 9, even here in the prologue chapter of the book, in chapter 1 and verse 9, God granted Daniel favor and compassion inside the commander and the officials. God granted Daniel favor. It wasn't just that Daniel was a persuasive speaker. It wasn't just that he knew how to twist people's arms and get things done. It's God's doing. It's God's providence. It's God who is still in control, even when everything from our perspective says otherwise. Young men who fear God and a God who provides what is needed. And so what we meet in this story about young men who don't have a price, who refuse to be compromised, who refuse to change who they are for what they can have or what they can be, is this book gives us a map for how to survive in Babylon, for how to survive in a corrupt and fallen world. I want you to look with me in Revelation chapter 18, and I just want you to notice something, because this really becomes an entry point for how we take stories like these that we read in the Old Testament, stories that seem so distant from who we are and where we're at now, and make these stories accessible to our own time and place. Because you see in the Bible, the city of Babylon, the rebellious city of Babylon, basically becomes a cipher, it becomes a metaphor, it becomes a type, an image of all cities, all countries, all empires, all cultures that exist in rebellion against God. And Revelation chapter 18, beginning of verse 1. Now understand, this is 500-600 years later. And John is writing about several empires later, the Roman Empire. And in Revelation chapter 18 and verse 1, and describing the downfall that is coming for the Roman Empire, and Romans 18 and verse 1, John writes this way. And after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, and he cried, fallen. Fallen is Babylon the Great. She's become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit, and the prison of every unclean and hateful bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her. And the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, listen now, come out from her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive of her plagues, for her sins have piled up as high as heaven. And God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to her deeds. In the cup which she has mixed twice as much for her, to the degree that she has glorified herself and lived sensuously, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, I sit as a queen, and I'm not a widow, and will never see mourning. And drop down to verse 24. And in her was found the blood of the prophets and of the saints and of all who have been slain on the earth. See what happens by the time you get into the Bible? Babylon represents ultimately, not just a literal Babylon that Daniel has to struggle with in his own days. Babylon represents all kingdoms and kings and empires and cultures and countries from all of human history, anytime, any place, that exists in defiance of God and of his values. And the message of God, whether it's Daniel's day or whether it's John's day to Christians of the Roman Empire or whether it's to us Christians sitting here in Houston in 2012, is come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, what the Bible says is whether you're Daniel or whether you're Jeff, it's always Babylon out there. And so Babylon is Babylon. Rome is Babylon. Las Vegas is Babylon. Houston is Babylon. The world is Babylon. And now, like then, we're still called to come out and to be separate, to set our heart, to make a determination that we will not defile ourselves with what the world offers us, because the world, now like then, believes that the people of God still have a price. That the world can offer us greatness on its own standards and in its own terms. And we will change who we are and become like them. That will accept the literature and the language of the Chaldeans, not just to know about it, but to live it and to like it. What Daniel and his friends never forgot, very quickly, we'll have 4 points here, is that they were exiles. That they might have all sorts of wonderful opportunities come their way, that they might have positions of amazing power open to them, but they never, ever, throughout the entire course of their lives, forgot that they were ultimately exiles, that they weren't Babylonians. Oh, they might have a Babylonian name, they might have a Babylonian job description, but at the end of the day, they were not Babylonians. They were Jews who feared the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were Jews who knew who they were. They were exiles. And that's the real power of the book of Daniel, is to remind us of what it means to live as an exile. Even one who's relatively, by the world standard, successful, but to always live as an exile in whatever version of Babylon you find yourself in. To be an exile, to live well, number one, to be an exile, you've got to learn to live with an awareness that God is in control. You've got to live with an awareness that God is in control. Daniel was not blindly or naively or simplistically optimistic about his situation. He was not naively happy. He simply lived from what the people of faith in the Bible always do, which is an understanding that in the Bible, people of faith always understand God is in control. And even if they don't know how their own personal story will end, they know how God's story will end. They know that God will set things right. They know that God's rule will be vindicated. They know that right will be shown to be right, that wrong will be grievously punished. They know how, even if they don't know how their own story ends, they know how God's going to end the story. And they live in light of that. They know that there is a God in heaven who, no matter what it looks like here and now, in my own time and place, in my own lifespan, that that God is still in control. You ever watch a game, a sports game, football, baseball, basketball, especially during playoff season maybe, when the stakes are high, it's win or go home type of situation. You ever watch a game, game 7 of the NBA Finals, if it had gone that far this year, and it all comes down to that one game, for instance. and oh, the tension, especially if you care, if it's a player you care about, a team you care about, the tension. You know, it's fourth quarter and there's 2 minutes left and it's tied score and any last basket might win it, and who's going to be the hero? And you live with all the wonder of how it's going to turn out, and you wonder and you're anxious and you're emotionally involved with it. You ever then go back and watch that game on DVR later? Do you have the same emotional experience? Maybe some of you diehard fans, you record certain Super Bowls or certain playoff games of things you just want to keep. Or you watch ESPN Classic and you watch games and where you already know who's going to win and how it's going to turn out. When you watch that game again later on and you get back to fourth quarter and there's 2 minutes left, there's just not the same emotional fear or concern or involvement because you already know who's going to win and how it's going to turn out. You know what I'm talking about? You know the dynamic I'm talking about? That's what God gets at in the Bible, I think. There's a difference in the anxiety that comes with, I don't know how my own life and how my own circumstances are going to turn out, versus the calm assurance when I know ultimately who's going to win the mess that we're involved in. I don't know right now how my life will turn out, but I will tell you something I'm absolutely convinced of, ladies and gentlemen, is that in the end, God wins. And I can sleep at night because I know God wins in the end. I don't know what's going to happen to me yet. I don't know what's going to happen to you yet. But I know in the end, like watching a game on a rerun, I know in the end who wins in the end. And so here's Daniel. He can't be more than a teenager. A teenager. And he's sitting in a strange place, further from home than you or I can imagine. No internet, no email, no snail mail even, so to speak. At least in a meaningful way. And he's just a teenager. And his God's things, his holy God's holy things, or in a pagan temple. And he's being basically pressed into a Babylonian mold. They've even taken his name, one of the most basic markers of human identity. They've taken his name away from him. He's not Daniel anymore to them. He's Belteshazzar. Has no idea how his life's going to turn out or where this is all headed. But you know something that Daniel knows? My God is still on his throne. And no matter what's happening to me right here and right now, I will not defile myself. I will come out, and I will still be separate. He knows that there is a God who's in control. Have no idea what's going on. Makes no sense to me. I don't know how this story is going to end, but I know my God is in control. To be in exile, you've got to live with an awareness of who is really in control. And to that end, number two, you've got to understand that now is merely temporary. That was merely temporary. It's simply not going to last, that long in the grand scheme of eternity. The Bible, from cover to cover, confesses our life is but a vapor. Our days go by as a sigh. Pick your passage and pick your metaphor, but what the Bible always reminds us of is, no matter what it seems like in the moment, life is short. You need to remember that what's going on now in our own personal situations, it's simply temporary. What is today is not what necessarily has to be tomorrow. I have no idea where my life is headed. I am called to live, therefore, by faith, by trust in God, because I know how he's going to end this story. My job is just to play the part in his story that he's written for me, even though I don't always know where it's headed. To be in exile, you've got to learn to remember that now is temporary. What you see is what will not always be. Jesus will come back. This age will end. Fire will be set. And all will be given their due justice, either through Jesus or on account of their own deeds before Almighty God. To be in exile is to understand that now is simply temporary. That's what it means to be in exile. Number three, even in a corrupt and godless age, proper authority still deserves its due respect. It's one of the interesting things about how Daniel and his friends conduct themselves. Have you ever noticed this aspect of the story in general? Even though it's a godless king, and even though it's a pagan education, and even though they are asked to do wicked things as the course of their lives go on, even though they are asked to waver and to give up in their commitment to God, they continue, even as they're being told to do wrong, to show respect to proper authority. That's a stunning thing. Look in Daniel chapter 1, even here in the passage that we're at most immediately. Daniel is always respectful. Verse 12, please test your servants. There's no demand. There's no ugliness. There's just a simple request. Please indulge us. Please humor us. I know it seems silly, but please give it a try. In Daniel chapter 2, when Daniel first makes his name truly great before Nebuchadnezzar, where now all his potential is lived up to and he's able to interpret, not just interpret, but tell the dream of the king when no one else can. In verse 28, beginning Daniel chapter 2, Daniel speaks this way to a king, to Nebuchadnezzar. However, there is a God in heaven who reveals mystery. He's made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will take place in the later days. Verse 29, as for you, O king, while on your bed, your thoughts turn to what would take place in the future. Verse 30, but as for me, this mystery has not been revealed to me for any wisdom residing me more than any other living man, but for the purpose of making the interpretation known to the king, and that you may understand the thoughts of your mind. See how respectful Daniel is there? You know, could have said, you know, king, this is really a story about how your kingdom's nothing and God's going to bring it to an end. That's what your dream was about, so get ready. You're going to get what you deserve for what you've done to my people and others like me. It's not what Daniel does. It's respect. He knows his place. Daniel chapter 4, another time when he has to tell Nebuchadnezzar what God's message is for him. In Daniel chapter 4, beginning of verse 19, then Daniel, whose name is Belteshazzar, was appalled for a while. That is, when he realizes what Nebuchadnezzar's dream is and what it means, that Nebuchadnezzar's literally going to lose his mind and go mad. He was appalled for a while as his thoughts alarmed him. And the king responded and said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. And so Belteshazzar replied, Daniel says, my lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. Now here's a perfect opportunity for Daniel, especially by this point in his career, to say, you know, king, you haven't learned yet. You're still an arrogant and proud man. It's about time you get what you have coming to you. God's going to embarrass you in front of the whole world. That's not what he does. He tells him the truth. But oh, Nebuchadnezzar, I wish it hadn't come to this. Oh, Nebuchadnezzar, I wish it were for someone else. In Daniel chapter 6, beginning of verse 19, now a whole other king, a whole other regime. Daniel has been thrown to the lion's den in the days of the Persians for the simple crime of praying to the one true God. He's cost nobody any money. He's not fomenting revolution. He's simply praying to the politically incorrect God of the time. In Daniel chapter 6 and verse 19, the king arose at dawn after Daniel has spent the night in the lion's den. The king arose at dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. And the king spoke to Daniel and said, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God whom you constantly serve been able to deliver you from the lions? And Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. He didn't say, of course he has. What were you thinking? He didn't say, I'm not talking to you anymore after you did that to me. He didn't say, man, I hope someday you get what you've got coming to you. O king, live forever. I'll tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it's really hard to show proper respect to authorities, if not for what they do, then simply for the position that they hold when we live in a godless age. Part of what it means to be an exile is to continue to show proper respect to even the wicked rulers among us. Because after all, as Daniel chapter 4 itself makes clear, the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men, and he gives it to whomever he wants. Or as Paul puts it so very clearly in Romans chapter 13, all authority is from God, and whoever resists that authority resists God and what he's doing. I will tell you, when we have lawgivers, and when we have executives who push an ungodly agenda, it's all the more time that we have to remember that while we don't certainly give credence or obedience to the godlessness, we respect the authorities that exist that have been ordained by God himself. We don't compromise. But even when those powers mean us ill, and want to do us wrong and harm us personally. Daniel, from the bottom of the lion's den, can say, O king, live forever. He can show proper respect because he knows where the authority that any king, any ruler ultimately has, where that authority actually comes from. And number fourth and finally, to be an exile, you need to accept your vulnerability. See, sometimes as Christians, we live in this godless age, this godless culture, as all people of God always have, by the way. We live in this dark and this difficult time in which the world, especially more and more, seems to be hostile toward us and out to get us. We need to learn that doing right is not a way of escaping the challenges and the problems and the risks and the dangers. To truly live as an exile is actually to increase our vulnerability to the abuse of the world. Certainly that was the case for Daniel and his friends, wasn't it? Why did Daniel wind up at the bottom of a lion's den in the first place? Well, because he was still living like an exile. Oh, he had a wonderful job description and a lot of earthly power, but at the end of the day, he still lived like an exile. What does it mean to live like an exile? To live like an exile wherever you're at is to never give up your language, your cultures, your clothing, your customs of wherever it is you've come from. What would Daniel never, ever give up throughout his entire life and his entire career? He always lived like an exile because he would never give up the culture, the religion of home, the worship of the one true God, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob's God. He always lived like an exile, no matter how else he served on a day-to-day basis. He always lived like an exile. But to do that was to make himself vulnerable to those who always hated him. How did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego wind up in the fiery furnace? Because even though they had risen to prominent positions in the Babylonian Empire, even though they were part of the king's A-team, they kept living like exiles. They would not compromise their culture and their religion and the worship of the one true God alone. I can do what the king asks only as long as he doesn't ask me to break the law of God. If the king wants me to be an accountant, I can be an accountant. If the king wants me to manage his affairs, I can manage his affairs. If the king asks me to worship an image, I can't do that. You see, no matter what my education is, and no matter what my job title says, I'm an exile. I'm ultimately still not from around here. Oh, I may have learned to speak your language. I may understand your literature. I may understand what you believe and why you believe it. But at the end of the day, I'm still an exile. If you're going to be an exile, you're always going to be vulnerable. 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter, by inspiration, recognizing that the people of God are always exiles, any age, any time, because it's always Babylon out there. As Peter himself will remark, even in 1 Peter chapter 5, she who is in Babylon greets you. It's always Babylon out there. And because it's always Babylon out there, the people of God are always exiles out there. And in 1 Peter chapter 2, beginning of verse 11, listen to what Peter writes to Christians. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers, as exiles and resident aliens, to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers. Why would they slander you as evildoers? Well, because you do things that condemn how they live. When you do what's right, it reminds them of how wrong they are. So in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. In other words, they'll be forced to confess when Jesus comes back in judgment in the last day. They'll be forced to confess that actually you were the right ones and they were the wrong ones. If you keep living as an exile, when God comes back and sets everything to right, the tables will be turned and you'll be the ones acknowledged as right. But in the meantime, verse 13, look at what he says, exactly what Daniel did. In the meantime, submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, but only when it does godly things. No, that's not what it says. Only when its authority is legitimate in your eyes. That's not what it says. You submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and the praise of those who do what's right. And I want you to understand something, ladies and gentlemen. Peter writes these words the person who was on the throne as king when Peter writes these words is the same ruler, the exact same man who secular history tells us had Peter put to death a few years later. I want you to think about that. You want to talk about practicing what you preach? Peter writes these words of the man who will ultimately have his own life taken away. Verse 15. For such is the will of God that by doing right, you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Don't break God's law for his sake, but you show him proper reverence and respect. If he's not doing right with the authority God's given him, he'll answer to God for that, but that's not your problem. Flip a page to chapter 4. Therefore, since Christ has suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose. Now again, we're still in the same book. This is still the letter written to people who need to see themselves as sojourners, as pilgrims, as strangers, as resident aliens, as exiles in this world. Since Christ has also suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same purpose, because he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. Drop down verse 4. In all this they are surprised, talking about the world, they are surprised that you do not run with them into the same excesses of dissipation, and they malign you. Drop down verse 12. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the exaltation, or excuse me, also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exaltation. If you are reviled in the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests on you. Make sure that none of you suffers as a murderer, or a thief, an evildoer, or a troublesome meddler. But if any of you suffers as a Christian, he is not to be ashamed, but is to glorify God in this name. Verse 19, therefore, those also who suffer according to the will of God shall entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. If you're going to be in exile, you're going to be vulnerable. Doing what's right doesn't make it easier. It makes it harder. If you live in Babylon, you live like an exile, you're going to be vulnerable. Even Daniel was vulnerable. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were vulnerable. God's righteous have always been vulnerable. That's why we need these stories. We need the comfort and the hope that they give. Of course, these stories all have happy endings. Ours don't always, do they? Jesus had to die. Many other prophets died. The apostles would die. And even Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in Daniel chapter 3, in a great moment in the story, admit to Nebuchadnezzar, they don't know whether or not God will actually save them from the fire. That's God's business, not theirs. That's God's decision, not theirs. But we will still not bow. Our God is able to deliver us. But even if he chooses not to, O King, we will not bow before your idol. These are great stories, ladies and gentlemen. These are stories that we can live in. These are stories about what it's like and what it means to be an outsider in a culture that absolutely believes that it has triumphed over God, like our own present age. These are stories about trying to find ways to keep the world from remaking us in its own image. These are stories about the risks and the blessings that come with the willingness to be used by God in difficult and unfair and unjust circumstances. These are stories about the challenge of being absolutely committed to God no matter what the consequences. Indeed, the Hebrew writer himself in Hebrews 5 and verse 8 points out, even Jesus learned the obedience through the things that he suffered. These are stories about life in exile, stories that will make us better people, stories that will make our children better people for knowing them and appreciating them. And above all, seeing them not just as simply wondrous miracles and demonstrations of God's power, but stories that remind us of what it means to be an outsider in the world, waiting for God to visit his people once again. It'll be a great week. Hopefully you've made plans for your children to be a part of it and are ready for it. And we pray that God will bless our efforts. Before we end this morning, we do want to offer an opportunity to get your life right with God if that's your need and your situation. If you have never confessed Jesus as Lord and Savior and Son of God, repented of your sins and been baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, we want to give you that opportunity this morning. You need to get your life right with God. Quit serving the world and serve the one true King of all the earth, of all of time, of all of eternity, God Almighty, through His Son, Jesus Christ. If that's your need this morning, we want to help you get right with Him. If you're this morning, you're a child of God already, but you have become a citizen of Babylon. You have compromised who you are. You are defiled this morning in the sight of Almighty God, and you know it. And your conscience is smiting you, and you know it's time to get it right this morning. We want to pray with you and for you about however you feel. God, we want to help and encourage you in whatever way we can to be right with God. If you'll share your need and what's on your heart with us right now this morning as we stay.